Okay. Boker Tov, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to installment number two of Zionist Profiles, the Lives and Labors of the Founding Fathers of the State of Israel. As I hope to demonstrate this morning, if you didn't get the pun in the title of the title of the series, you'll get it today. The Lives and Labors of the Founding Fathers of the State of Israel, what will be very much characteristic of Israel from its founding, I should say even before, 20 years before its founding, until essentially 1977, in which there was a political shift in the country through the election of Likud, through the shift into some would say right-wing, I would say less socialist, it's probably a better characteristic of it in terms of its effect, early labor-dominated bend. Until that point, the founding of the State of Israel, the founding of Medinatenu HaKadosha, was very much characterized by the popular movements of the early 20th century. We all know who David Ben-Gurion is. It is impossible to cover his life in a single 1 hour of a lecture. I think if we wanted to do four shiurim just on Ben-Gurion, we probably could have done a decent job. So I had to pick and choose about what we were going to do. So what I've chosen to do is we're going to start at the early part, similar to what we did with Jabotinsky. We're going to start at the earlier parts of his life, and we're going to focus on the things that I think are less well known, where most of us, to the extent that we read about Ben-Gurion's life, we are familiar with him and his role as Prime Minister for the first 15 years of Medinat Yisrael. We are less familiar with what led up to that. Ben-Gurion was a larger-than-life figure, right? He's, in any rating of the 20th century's most important figures, he's usually up there in the top few. He was, by the sheer force of his will, if there is somebody who's solely responsible, right? There is no one person that's solely responsible, but if there is somebody who is perhaps most responsible for the founding and the establishment of Medinat Yisrael, Ben-Gurion has to be in the top couple of candidates. He was somebody who was a masterful politician, but at the same time, somebody who tactically, from a military perspective, did not have really any experience at all before going into the 1948 war. He was somebody who had a tenacity to him, but did not have a natural charm. And now when we think of, and I just want to use a couple of historical parallels so you understand where I'm coming from. When we think of somebody like an Abraham Lincoln, or we think of somebody like a Winston Churchill, somebody who has a past and somebody who has a history, but in the end, their greatness was more in the fact that they were political leaders. Those are two excellent examples of people who were by no means founding fathers. They were not founders of a movement. They were not founders of a revolution. They were not in any way founders of a state. They were people that took a long-standing existing state, obviously Churchill much longer than Lincoln, but there were two figures who took a long-standing tradition of leadership, and they used their own political know-how, they used their natural affinity for people and with people, their natural skills with people, and they were able to harness that into quality leadership and able to make people bend people to their will in a way that few leaders are able to. It's a thread that is that's hard to pull off by leaders in general, right? Which is why a Churchill and a Lincoln are a Churchill and a Lincoln because of just how rare they are. But when you think about founding movements, in almost all and in the vast majority of cases throughout history of founding national movements, the first leaders, the founding leaders, are almost always military leaders. And it's not necessarily because military leaders are the best and brightest and most capable governmental policy leaders, but it is because when a founding movement starts with war, right? And this is just across the board. When the founding movement starts with war, the only way for everybody to coalesce, the only way for everybody to join under a single banner is to have a figure that everybody recognizes. And it's the most natural thing in the world. After the surrender of the British in 1781, George Washington retired. And he went back to his house intending to be a farmer for the rest of his life. And it was only when the country needed everybody to gather under one banner and to be able to unite under one name when they were establishing the Constitution in 1787 and they needed this one person to fill the vacancy of president that they pulled Washington out of retirement because they knew that he was the one figure that could actually unite the country. That is your typical, all right, if somewhat atypical because he spent the time off, those 6 years, but that is your typical founding leader. When it comes to, right, I mean, if you want to take a modern example, there was the military coup in Egypt only a few years ago, and Al-Sisi was the general who led the coup. He was the one that took over the country, and naturally, who is going to be the person who's elected who's elected president after that coup? It was al-Sisi, and he basically retired as a general and became a politician. That is much more common in terms of throughout human history. Ben-Gurion is a fascinating exception to this. He was somebody who had virtually, leading up to the Milchemet HaShechurot, the War of Independence in 1948 and 49, he was somebody who had virtually no military experience. The little that he had, we will discuss. He was somebody who did not get along well with people. He was an acerbic guy who had a long history of meeting people who did not like him. Yet, he not only was able to be the founding prime minister of the state of Israel, not only was able to gather people around him and marshal a government that ruled the country and led the country for 15 years at its founding, but he was able to do so, right? And historians will debate this till this day, but he was able to do so with a clear founding ideology, and he was able to do so to some extent very effectively. Under Ben-Gurion's watch, the population of the state of Israel in a small period of time quadrupled. Right? There's no such thing in all of human history as a state that in that short span of a time quadrupled. It's crazy. It's a crazy thing to think of. It would be the equivalent in the United States of America, which of course is a much larger scale. It would be the equivalent of the United States of America from going from 300 million people to 12 million, all right, to 1.2 million people to 1.2 million people within a span of 15 years. That's crazy. And yet, obviously, we know the historical circumstances that led to that. But the fact that he was able to lead the country to some degree of success and prosperity, to some degree of military success, you know, in a number of instances, and basically put the country on track to be able to develop and continue to succeed to the point that we now today not only have the powerhouse of the military of the state of Israel, we have the powerhouse diplomatically of the state of Israel, we also have the powerhouse in terms of technology, in terms of productivity, in terms of happiness and just contentment in life. And it's one of the most beautiful countries in the region. And of course, you know, the Zionist mythology about how we needed to, in order for it to happen, the founding generation needed to make the desert bloom. So who was this Ben-Gurion? And why is it that he, in 1948, was able to take the mantle of leadership in a way that is really very atypical when it comes to movements throughout history? Who was this fellow Ben-Gurion, and where did he come from, and how did he get to be who he was and become the legendary leader that he was? So it's that I would like to discuss today. Now again, we're not going to be able to cover his whole life. As you see, he lived from 1886 to 1973, but we are going to go pretty much to the late 30s. That's my plan for the time that we have this morning. Let me just give a quick first honorable mention to some of the books that I consulted. I mentioned this last year when we were doing some other stuff that related to Ben-Gurion. This is Anita Shapiro's biography of Ben-Gurion. It was published a few years ago. It was translated a little bit more recently. It was originally written in Hebrew. Magnificent, magnificent work. Very, very readable. It reads like a novel. So I can't recommend this enough. It's also only about 250 pages. This study we've also consulted before. This is Benny Morris's relatively recent study on the Milchemet HaShechur, the 1948 war. We're not going to get too much of that today, but again, I think that this is essential reading for anybody that wants to understand the tumultuous years of the late 40s and early 50s of Medina Israel, which of course led to the Medina Israel that we know today. This is another book that I consulted. This is actually just a collection of primary sources that are specifically about the founding, you know, this is exactly our topic, the founding fathers of the State of Israel, right, is edited by Yaron Kaplan and Derek Penslar. This is a English translations of documents, of speeches, of letters, of things, important policy and ideological things that were said and written by, again, founding fathers, people that starting from the mid-19th century all the way till 1948. Ben-Gurion is featured prominently here, as well as a number of his compatriots, Chaim Weizmann, Burl Katzelson, a number of people that we're going to be discussing today. Finally, this is actually the one thing that I read for, you know, in honor of this lecture for the first time. I got it a couple weeks ago. Shimon Peres, this is very interesting. I wouldn't say that this is essential reading by any means, but a few years ago, Shimon Peres was basically interviewed by this guy David Landau, and they wrote and the interview was solely about Ben-Gurion. They spoke about Ben-Gurion for hours, and the transcripts of that conversation were put together and put into a book. So obviously, from a historical perspective, this is not exactly a historian's bread and butter, but it is a very, you know, of course, we know Perez, he only passed away very recently, and it's a very interesting collection of thoughts and ruminations and reflections on somebody that really lived through not only the entire founding of the State of Israel, but was a close and personal friend and colleague of David Ben-Gurion throughout his career. So, very interesting. I enjoyed it very much. If anybody's interested, I'm happy to lend some of this out, if you'd like. Okay, so, Ben-Gurion, who was he? Born in 1886 to 1973, and I'd like to everybody to keep in mind some of the things that we spoke about last week. For those of you who were here, I think it was most of you, for those of you who were here last week when we spoke about Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky was born in 1880, 6 years earlier. Now, ordinarily, a six-year difference between two ideologues, between two political figures, wouldn't matter all that much, except for the fact that this is a period in history where 6 years meant a whole lot. A lot. If you were 14, right? If Ben-Gurion was 14 at a point when Jabotinsky was 20, right? That means that he missed 6 years of adulthood that Jabotinsky, right, was ahead of him in. And that was a point in which already Jabotinsky was active. We know, we spoke about last week, Jabotinsky was already left home from Odessa and as an 18-year-old and was already engaged, minimally at the beginning, but within a couple of years, very, very actively, starting from the 1903 in the Sixth Zionist Congress, Jabotinsky was very actively involved in the Zionist cause. That's an important 6 years. That's an important 6 years. He was 23 at the time, which means that at that point, Ben-Gurion was 17. Not quite old enough to be fully engaged. He was still at home. He was still living at home in his in the shtetl that he grew up in. So the point that I'll just open up with is that's a very, very significant to realize that a few years in this stage, a few years that it takes to grow up from a young teenager to an older teenager, from a teenager to an adult, were critical. And the fact that Ben-Gurion missed certain things that Jabotinsky did not, very much is reflective of that. Right? Just as one silly example, Jabotinsky was able to meet Theodor Herzl, because in 1903 Jabotinsky was already 23 years old, and he was already well known, and he was published. And we said that what really his first claim to fame was the fact that he published the Chaim Nachum Bialik's Ir HaHariga, which was this devastating poem describing the Kishinev pogrom of 1903. So we said that was his coming out party. That was when Jabotinsky first hit the world stage, which is why he was selected to go to the Zionist Congress in 1903. The Ben-Gurion was a very active from a very early age and would have been a perfect candidate for that kind of thing, but the fact that he was 6 years younger meant that he missed it. Has anybody here watched a little bit or all of Downton Abbey? Okay, so I mention it because it's for anybody who doesn't know, it's an interesting historical drama that was on the BBC a few years ago, finished a few years ago, and it's about a family from who was a lord in Yorkshire, in Great Britain, in London, in England, at the turn of the 20th century. That is the exact period that we're talking about. And the reason that I mention it is because one of the things that I think that the show did really, really well is give off this sense, this impression that everybody around, leading up to World War I, with the social movements and revolutions that were going on in Eastern Europe and Russia, and with World War I and the aftermath of World War I, the show did a really good job at giving off the sense that everybody who lived at that period felt like that they were living history. Like things were changing and they were never going to be the same. This was a period that saw technological advancement to the likes of which human history has never seen. Right? We went from, within 20 years, we went from a horse and buggy to actually flying planes, right? Which was, before, you know, 20 years earlier, was a myth. It was a fantasy. And it became widespread within a 20-year period. Now, that's just one example of just how much the world was changing in such a short period of time. That is where the Zionist movement is falling at this period in history. When things are changing, borders are changing, cultures are changing, countries are changing the way they do business, movements are developing. There's a fervor there's a popular fervor, the likes of which human history hadn't seen for a very long time, if ever. And it is the passionate and dedicated and committed Zionists of the late 19th and early 20th century to whom we owe Medinat Yisrael. Because it was them, it was people like Ben-Gurion who will be discussing today, who had the vision that in this time of change, this is the time, more than anything else, this is the time to be able to seize on that popular change and harness it towards a change for the sake of the movement of Zionism. So, who was Ben-Gurion? Born in 1886 in Płońsk. Płońsk is about the very, very center of Poland. I put another map here. There's much fewer places. I actually didn't. There's more places to put on. I just didn't get around to it. But Płońsk, you'll see, is over here. It's the very center of Poland. All right? It's about 60 kilometers northwest of Warsaw. And you'd think that seeing as how it's such a close suburb of Warsaw, it actually would have been somewhat of a cosmopolitan place, or at least had access to this urban area of Warsaw. But the fact is that throughout Ben Gurion's childhood, there were no paved roads. This was a very small place. There was 8,000 people in total that lived in Płońsk. It's a tiny, tiny area. 60% of that 8,000, if not that, then somewhere around that vicinity, 60% of the population of those 8,000 souls were Jewish. And of those Jews, almost all were of a Hasidic ideology. So this was your classic, your typical shtetl. All right, now, again, contrast that to the character that we were looking at last week of Jabotinsky, who was the rare Jew who actually grew up in a city, in the Pale of Settlement. Odessa was the one city that actually allowed Jews to live in, and Jabotinsky grew up with a culture that Ben-Gurion never had. Jabotinsky grew up with an education that Ben-Gurion never had. Jabotinsky grew up with a certain inquisitiveness and knowledge of the world that Ben-Gurion never could have. And the two really are polar opposites in so many different ways, which I think will become evident the more we talk about it. Okay, so this was Ben-Gurion. He was born into this little shtetl with muddy dirt roads, and he was a chassid growing up, the same way that everybody else is. He attended cheder like every other kid in the shtetlach, and he was expected to continue in yeshiva like every other kid in the shtetlach. But it turns out that he actually didn't really care much about yeshiva, and he got to the age of 14, Ben Gurion actually leaves school. He leaves yeshiva, and so while he had the core education of a kid growing up in the shtetl from his early age for his first 14 years of his life, something that he would knowledge and a cultural base that he will draw on for the rest of his career anytime he's in the room with religious Jews, right? He was able to quote a few Gemaras and Mishnayos and Psukim at the top of his head because of his early education. Despite that, he left yeshiva at a pretty early age, far earlier than what was expected at that stage in history and in that type of locale. Nevertheless, he didn't leave home. There's actually very little evidence. There's very little hard evidence that we have from the period from when he left school until a few years later. A few years later is which we'll get into. But for that period, from about age 14 to 17, Shapira says that it's clouded in mystery. We're not really sure because he didn't really write much about it. The assumption we have to make is that he was helping his father in his father's business, and at the same time he also was learning Hebrew, because one of the things that we know, one of the things that characterizes Ben-Gurion from a very early age, and this is to some extent predicting the rest of his life, is that at a very early age, very uncharacteristically, he was passionate. He was ardently passionate about the language of Hebrew. And because of that, he taught himself how to read Hebrew. And he was taught the basics at an early age, like anybody is. And then he taught himself how to read a poetic Hebrew at a very early age. Again, we're talking in the 1890s here. This was Eliezer ben Yehuda was working on his movement in Palestine, in Ottoman Palestine at the time. But Hebrew was not a very widespread language. We pointed out last week that Jabotinsky had more fame from Bialik's poem than Bialik did, because nobody could read Bialik's poem. It was written in Hebrew. Jabotinsky translated it into Russian, and then Jabotinsky was the one that was famous, not Bialik. Which is ironic and everything, of course, but it's also reflective, it's indicative of what Hebrew was at that period in history. So Ben-Gurion, at a very early age, has a liking to Hebrew, and predicts the fact, what is perhaps his greatest cognitive skill, is that he has a knack for languages. There's a number of examples throughout his career where he picks up a language, works on it, and labors through it, and after a few months is fluent and is able to read and write and speak fluently. Similar to what we saw with Jabotinsky last week. So that was Ben-Gurion at an early age. He loved Hebrew and he studied Hebrew. And because he was reading Hebrew, because he loved it so much, he had access to the early Zionist works that were written in Hebrew. He read Hachad Ha'am, he read Chaim Nachum Bialik, he read Yosef Chaim Brenner, he read some of these early Zionists that actually wrote in Hebrew, and he was able to imbibe the message and the culture and the Weltanschauung that they were putting forth in the original language. And that created a deep, deep-seated passion for Yeshuv Eretz Yisrael, for the Jewish settlement in the land of Israel. very early age. Okay, why do I start with all of that? Because there's 50 years after Ben-Gurion left Plansk, after he retired from the government in Israel, there was a letter found in the World Zionist Archives, which is fascinating, just absolutely fascinating, when you consider what it was and who was writing it and what the purpose of it was. Ben-Gurion was born to Avigdor Green, who was married to a woman named Shendel. Shendel dies when Ben-Gurion was 11. It's a death, and it's a death and a trauma that he actually never gets over. It's actually another one of the similarities between Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion is that they actually lost a parent early on. In the Zionist archives found in the 60s, they found a letter that was written in 1901 when Ben-Gurion is 15 years old. 1901, by Avigdor Green to Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl, who has now become one of the most famous Jews in the world. Avigdor Green, who was a little merchant who lives in a little shtetl with 8,000 people, all of whom were Hasidim, all the way in the middle of backwards Plansk with no paved roads, he writes to the most famous Jew in the world, and what he wants to tell him is that I have this son who is brimming with talent, brimming with passion, and he is the kind of guy that would do great for you. You would be amazing. So this is the first source. The sources that I have, most of these sheets today are going to be a timeline with some pictures and some historical documents. The actual sources that I want to read are in blue and numbered. So source number one on page number one. You see this is a picture of Avigdor Green. This is another picture of the Pale of Settlement that we mentioned last week. This letter is what was found in the Zionist archives. This is the actual letter that was written by Avigdor Green to Herzl in 1901. And it is hysterical when you read the Hebrew that it's written in a really just a highfalutin Hebrew, which was clearly indicative of the fact that Green didn't speak a lick of Hebrew. He was using all these random Talmudic phrases here and there because he didn't know how to actually write a regular letter in Hebrew. And the truth is his son would have done a much better job writing a reference letter for himself than him. The king of his people who converses with the nations, who before kings he reports, Mr. Herzl, may his light continue to shine, Nero Yoyer. Even though I cannot personally come before my master, the exalted one, whose life's goal and mission is the matters of the nation, I nevertheless feel that a particular issue of a personal nature is relevant to the concerns of the masses. I therefore decided to express to you, my master, what my issue is. All right, I'm just cutting and pasting here. I too, a youth among the masses of Israel, have been blessed by God with a magnificent son who is diligent in his studies and is still today in his youth, aged 15. His belly is filled with learning, and his only language is that of Hebrew. He didn't literally mean that he only spoke Hebrew, but that it was his greatest passion was Hebrew. But he also is knowledgeable in the country's language, has knowledge of mathematics, etc., and his soul thirsts for learning. Ben-Gurion was an autodidact for pretty much for a large portion of his life. After he left Cheder, he's trying to educate himself. And his father, who was a simple Jew, who was a simple merchant, who didn't know anything from anything when it came to education, was looking at his son hitting the books every single night in his room and said, oh my gosh, look at how passionate this guy is. I should have mentioned at the outset, Avigdor Green was somebody who was a passionate Zionist himself. Zionism reached in the late 19th century, it reached Plansk, as it did many areas in Poland, even religious areas. Not, of course, it was a source of conflict in many religious areas as well, but Avigdor Green taught his children Zionism. So in addition to his love for language and his love for Hebrew and the early works that he was studying, it has to be said that Ben-Gurion was getting his early Zionism from his father. And his father, recognizing how passionate his son is and how talented his son is, writes to Herzl. Now, it's somewhat comical that how naive Green was, that he actually thought that Herzl might ever respond to this. He asks for a response. What, can you give me some advice what to do with my son? Is there anything you could do with my son? Can he be helpful to you? And I send him to you. Like, Herzl was the most famous Jew in the world, and he was writing, right? It would be the equivalent of you having your son failing his math class, and you decide that you're going to write to Jared Kushner, right? That's the first guy off the top of my head. You decide to write to Benjamin Netanyahu. That's a bad example. You decide to write to Benjamin Netanyahu because your son's doing bad in math. Or your son is really passionate about his Israel club in school, right? And you're expecting him to write back. That's, kind of what this is equivalent to. And it's again, a reflection of how out of touch people in these shtetlach were about who these famous Jews were, right? You think I could write to my uncle who's the famous guy in the next town over and he'll respond. I could write to Herzl in Vienna. Okay, so you see, so that was Avigdor Green. He recognized at an early age just how much talent and passion
Ben-Gurion has, and considering the fact that he was a person that was not marked for his talent for the majority of his career, it's very interesting, and you know, all fathers dote on their children to some extent, but it is very interesting that he was so attuned to this, specifically the fact that Kurtzel was the best person to be writing to in this respect. It's interesting that that was seen at an early stage. Okay. The letter was found, yeah, so all of Herzl's papers were left in the World Zionist Organization's archives. And then it was unearthed in the 60s, and Ben-Gurion, and I don't know if Ben-Gurion, I'm assuming Ben-Gurion himself didn't find it, but somebody found it and showed it to Ben-Gurion. And Ben-Gurion, this is 50, 60 years later after this letter had been written, then Ben-Gurion saw this letter that, you know, you can imagine what it must have been for him, which is a fascinating piece of history.
No,
Herzl, I mean, this is the way it happened. Before, you know, mass letter writing, stuff got filed, right? I mean, this is what you would do when you were an organization. The first character of an organization is that you had a file cabinet and you fill it up, right? It's just the way it goes. My father, when he asked me to help clean out his office, we were cleaning out files from the 60s, right? And before he even, it's just the way it happens. In the pre-computer age, you got papers and you were very hesitant to throw them away and you would just file them. So that's where this letter was found. No, so I'm saying Herzl didn't, it was never on the cards. Herzl was the most famous Jew in the world. It's unlikely that Herzl ever even saw this letter. But it's neither here nor there. The point is, if he saw it, it's unlikely that he ever read past the first two lines. I'm not quoting it because of anything that Herzl did. I'm quoting it because of how, and this is really, the truth is, this is really the only direct connection that we can ever draw between Ben-Gurion and Herzl. Okay, we got a lot to talk about Herzl, about Ben-Gurion himself, though, so let's move on. Okay, at the age of 11, Shendel dies. Shortly after his bar mitzvah, he leaves yeshiva in 1900, influenced by Zionism. This is actually another very very fascinating piece of his, or on the last bullet of 1900, on page 1. This is a fascinating piece of his history that you think about the types of things that we did when we were 14, 15 years old. Think about the types of things that our kids do when they're that age. What did he do? Influenced by the Zionism that was sweeping through Europe, David Ben-Gurion, along with two friends from Plansk, formed the Ezra Youth Movement, which sought to learn and disseminate Hebrew as a spoken language. Now, when I was 15, I was interested in video games, and I was interested in the Mets. And Ben-Gurion actually was, this is a very early age, he was a precocious kid. He was so early, he was so passionate about the Hebrew language, and about Hebrew culture, and about Hebrew poetry, that he actually formed an organization, right? This is an 8,000 people in this town. So, you know, it's like a lemonade stand, I guess, to some extent. But he still was doing that for the sake of other people learning about how important Hebrew was and learning to become conversant
so
in it.
He was a contemporary of Eliezer Ben Yehuda, except that Eliezer Ben Yehuda was a
colleague. He was a junior colleague of Eliezer Ben Yehuda. Eliezer Ben Yehuda's career started earlier. Ben-Gurion definitely knew about it. Ben-Yehuda eventually definitely is going to know about it. I forget when Ben-Yehuda dies, but he was not. Ben-Yehuda was really a part of a growing movement of popularizing the Hebrew language. What Ben-Yehuda did that was unique and probably his most important contribution is that for the first years of his son's life, he actually raised him without allowing him to hear a word other than Hebrew, what ended up happening was that Eliezer Ben Yehuda's kid, I forget his name, was the first person in like 2,500 years that actually spoke Hebrew as his natural language. And that, believe it or not, that snowballed. And then there was a group of students in the early 20th century in Tel Aviv that basically took this on. And because of that, I don't remember if Ben Yehuda's kid was one of them, but there was, and that was basically when the population of Israel was small enough, just that few hundred kids that took it upon themselves to disseminate Hebrew, the population was small enough that it actually caught like wildfire. Not only was that, but they were the people that were most active in the immigrant absorption. So it wasn't the guy who was speaking Yiddish in the cheder in Yerushalayim or in Hebron. It was the guy that was studying Hebrew and now he took it on as a national language. He was the one that was helping the guy from Poland disembark. And that's kind of how Hebrew spread. It's really one of the miracles, and I say that I can't emphasize that enough. One of the miracles of the Hakamat HaMdina and really of human history is a language that has been dead as a spoken language for more 2.5 millennia actually gets revived, and it is the language of the culture. It's the language of academia. It's the language of everything in Israel. It's fascinating. But
if you look at the letter of the father, his Hebrew is beautiful.
It's terrible. It's.
Oh,
yeah, well, yeah, well, okay, fine. So he knew how to write Hebrew. And he's familiar enough with the language that he could conjugate verbs, but he had no spoken Hebrew. It was all Talmudic language. So we read it now, and it looks silly. He's like, you know, he apologizes for something. Slach lo lanu avinu ki chatanu, mechal lanu makinu, something like that. Because he doesn't know how to say, I'm sorry. Right? Something like that. Okay, moving on. So, 1903. So keep it. Yeah, so stuff like that. He's calling Herzl the king of his people. All right, again, due to his ignorance and also due to his fact that he just didn't have the language. He also could have written to Herzl in Russian, and Herzl probably would have been fine. But we can conjecture why it is that he felt the need to write in Hebrew. Herzl's Hebrew wasn't, you know, was not natural. Okay, so 1903, we pointed out last week. 1903 is the Kishinev pogrom, which actually had minimal effect on Plansk. But the result of the Kishinev program was this popular movement to do something now, which is what led to the Sixth Zionist Congress that we spoke about last week, that Jabotinsky was in attendance for, the Sixth Zionist Congress, in which the Uganda plan was presented by Herzl. And if you recall, the Uganda plan was not to present it to a vote whether or not we should accept the Uganda plan. The vote that was put up at the Sixth Zionist Congress was whether or not we should send a delegation of people to this territory that the British government has allocated, has offered to us to research, right, to have a fact-finding mission as to whether or not it is feasible for Jewish settlement. And that caused a huge ruckus, as we spoke about last week. Okay, Theodore, again, this is another important difference about when you see those critical 6 years. Jabotinsky, who was 23 at this point, Ben-Gurion is 17, still living in his parents' home. So in 1903, the news of the Sixth Zionist Congress and what happened with the Uganda plan spreads like wildfire. Papers are reporting on it, the media is reporting on it all over Europe. And Ben-Gurion sees this event, and he's livid because he's been, right, for the last 4 or 5 years, try and think about a passionate teenager, even if it's what they're passionate about is chemistry or the Mets, all right? Think about a 17-year-old who cares about the Mets more than anything in the world, and then, we'll use a better example. Think about a 17-year-old who cares about the New York Giants or the Brooklyn Dodgers more than anything in the world, and then suddenly as a 17-year-old is told that they're moving to L.A., all right? They're moving to San Francisco. So that's or Lahavdil, but that's it's devastating for a kid, all right? Yeah, some of you may, you know, maybe in that boat, I don't know. My father talks about it. So it was a big deal, and he was crestfallen. So what he did at that point, with him and his few friends that were starting Ezra, this Hebrew, this student group that was meant to promote Hebrew in Plansk, that was the point at which he decided unequivocally that he was going to move to Eretz Yisrael. He was going to immigrate to Ottoman Palestine. Okay, he was still 17 and he had no plan on how to do it. So what he decides to do was he wants to be able to be a productive member of society. So what he decides to do is move to Warsaw, right, again, 60 miles southeast, and he's going to go to school in Warsaw. He's going to get he originally was planning on getting an engineering degree or something similar to it, and in doing so, he's going to make himself, develop some type of skill that will be useful for his life in Ottoman Palestine. Again, you have to understand how quickly this historical movement happened. At this point in time, nobody was dreaming about a Jewish state. I mean, they were dreaming about a Jewish state, but they weren't. They didn't know what state was going to take. Right now, the Ottoman Empire controlled what was then Ottoman Palestine, and it was more of a territory than there was no statehood for Palestine. Palestine was known as a territory, right? The Levant or South Syria. It was just one of these things that gets called. It's kind of like referring to it as the Northwest Territory or New England. I think the best thing for Palestine is probably calling it New England. If 100 years from now, people who are the grandchildren of people that grew up in Rhode Island got up and say, we're not Rhode Islanders, we're New Englanders, and it was the United States government that bereft us, stole our rights and forced us into, not being able to recognize our natural right of self-rule. That would be kind of silly, because we know that there's no such thing as New Englanders. There's the same way that there's no such thing as Palestinians, technically speaking. It's not that there weren't indigenous peoples that were living there, and not that they didn't have a right to nationalism themselves, but the idea of Palestine as an independent territory, as an independent state, was on nobody's mind here. It was basically in a borderless territory that was governed by the Ottoman Empire for the last 500 years. So that's the place that they decide to go. But in the Zionist Congress, they wouldn't know if it was going to be an independent state, if it was going to be a client state of the Ottoman Empire, if they were going to, there were some people already early on that were talking about fighting and having a military uprising and fighting for the independence. But that was very, very minuscule at this point in time. So we don't really know what what was going on in his head about what he thought the future of his life in Palestine was going to be. But what he did know was that the future was there, and he was going to take this passion that he had for the Hebrew language, for Hebrew culture, for ancient Jewish culture, and supplant what he thought, what many in that era thought, were the backwards traditions of his upbringing, of his kapata and his shtreimel, and, oh, he didn't wear it, what, I don't know, but his kapata and his payas, and he was going to replace them, he was going to supplant them with the Jewish culture, right, the Jewish culture of Hebrew and nationalism in the land of Israel. Okay, so in 1904 he moves to Warsaw. He started a degree in engineering. In 1905, amid the Russian Revolution, okay, this is a very, again, there's so much going on in the world at this time that this, it's not surprising. This is where the popular movements were happening. In 1905, the Russian Revolution breaks out, and Poalei Tzion is a workers, known as, right, translated as workers of Tzion, workers of Zion. It was a political party that was formed in Poland. Ben Gurion attended the founding meeting while he was in Warsaw, and he ended up joining the party. Poalei Tzion combined Marxist socialism and Zionism. The Communist Manifesto, right? Karl Marx's his founding work, which defined human history, and as we know in hindsight, defined some pretty lousy human history for a very long time. But the Communist Manifesto was written for 50 years earlier, and it was started out as a grassroots movement in Russia, and it kind of came to a crescendo in the first decade of the 20th century when communism was taking over, and the Tsarist Russia, which had been in rule since colonial times, we started last week with John Quincy Adams going to Russia in the 1780s, right? Tsarist Russia, which had been around for centuries, it was replaced. The Tsars were still around for another 10, 15 years, for another 12 years, but it was replaced with a representative democracy. And they and that was when this movement of communism, of socialism, really took hold. The Poalei Tzion, the Workers' Party, was a political movement that sought the goal of Zionism, which was Jewish immigration and Jewish flourishing in life in the land of Israel, combined with the idea that that state should be one of Marxist socialism. Okay, 1906, by then an extremely active member of Poalei Tzion, this is very early on, all right, Ben-Gurion in 1905, if he was born, so at this point he's 19 years old, and he becomes very active politically. Think of the kid on the college, we spoke about these ages, but it's a good comparison for us, because it's a reference point that we can understand. Think of the 19-year-old college kid who suddenly has become a Bernie Sanders fanatic, okay? Not that I have anything wrong with Bernie Sanders supporters. I'm just saying, like, you see, you and I could vote for Bernie Sanders and be measured and say, okay, I like this part of his policy, I don't like this part of his policy, but either way, I still got to go to work the next morning and earn a living. And regardless of what Bernie Sanders is going to do for the country, you know, my life is going to go on. That's not the way a 19-year-old thinks. A 19-year-old thinks when they have this passion, right? When they get all excited, it's as neurologically, right? I speak from in terms of my other profession. You get very, very, very focused and very blindsided. What?
On the bandwagon.
Yeah, but it's not just being. We can be on the bandwagon for something and still be able to see other things. Ben Gurion at this point was so solely focused on something, and I'm just. Urging you to think of it in terms of the 19-year-old college kid who gets excited about an idea and can't, and everything else is secondary to it. So that was Ben Gurion at this stage. He becomes a very active member of Poalei Tzion. This is still in Poland, in the Russian Empire, and he decided that there's little remaining for him in Poland. He has a very difficult time getting any type of education in Warsaw because he never actually had a matriculation certificate from Płońsk. He tried to forge one, he couldn't forge one, so he did a little bit of studying, but it never really amounts to anything. And once he decides that there's nothing left for him in Poland, that's when he decides... that he hopes to continue to. He finally found this passion that he was good at, and he felt there was an avenue for him to succeed. And that's when he decided in 1906 to immigrate to Palestine. And he goes. He departs from Płońsk in July and arrives in Yafo on September 6, 1906. And upon his arrival in Eretz Israel, David Green changed his surname to his last name to Ben Gurion. David Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion actually is an interesting character. He named himself after somebody that lived in the first century of the Common Era, who's somebody that comes up in the Apocrypha, right, in the in the biblical books that are not part of the biblical canon. He was somebody who resisted the Roman Empire. And Ben-Gurion said, okay, now we're going to have the Jews are going to be an independent polity in the land of Israel. I'm going to take on this name. of Ben-Gurion to honor this notion of independence and resistance and, you know, bravery and toughness. Okay, so that was stage number one. That's Plonsk. He's now a 20-year-old. He disembarks in Yafo. And now, what's he going to do? What he came to the land to do is to be an active member of Pohelei Tzion. Now, Pohelei Tzion was about working. The whole idea was working the land, was getting up, right, clocking in and going to work every day and saying that the land is going to be redeemed and our society is going to be developed based on hard work. So he says, okay, the natural thing for me to do is to get my, grab my briefcase and go to work. And what was the rage back then, and not just the rage, but it was actually part of the party platform, was to do agricultural work. Until that point, there was Jews that were doing agriculture for 30 years in the country, 20, 25 years. The minhag for the first 20, 25 years was that the Jews would set up a farming area and then they would hire Arab workers. And Pohelei Tzion, one of their big movements was that it should be, right, these are the young laborites in Israel in its nascent movement, was that the labor should be done, everything should be done by the Jews. Everything should be done by the Jews. So he said, okay, I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to go be an agricultural worker. So he goes into, so that's what he starts to do. He starts off by going, by working on a number of different places, and it actually turns out that he has not much of a knack for it, and he really doesn't enjoy it, right? And Ben-Gurion paints himself for the rest of his life as this agricultural worker, right, to the point that he actually retires. He says he's retiring to Stable Care at the end of his career, which is this yeshuv in the Negev, so that he can go back to being an agricultural worker, so he can go back to being a regular worker in Palestine. In the end, he actually spent very little of his life doing work. He was not a kibbutznik by any stretch of the imagination. His greatest talent and the only area in which he succeeded in his life was in his political activity. So he becomes an active member of Pohelei Tzion, which again is an international movement, and he runs in as he is basically disembarking in 1906 with a competing political movement, which was Hapoel HaTzair. Right? Think about it. Pohelei Tzion, which is the workers of Tzion. Hapoel HaTzair, which is the young worker. So they have similar names. Ben-Gurion actually was of the opinion that these two movements didn't have that much difference between them. No, not any real substantive difference. Hapoel HaTzair actually didn't have much of a platform, didn't have much of a clear defining ideology, but nevertheless, they still were believed in their distinctiveness because they were the party that was founded in Eretz Yisrael as opposed to Pohelei Tzion, which was an international movement with offices in major cities across Europe and even in America. So that's what happens. But Ben-Gurion is actually a member of Pohelei Tzion. So again, it's confusing. So try and keep these two names in mind. Pohelei Tzion and Hapoel HaTzair. These are these two political movements, all right, which is really comical when you think about the sheer number of people that are in Israel at the time. The number of Jews, we're numbering in the tens of thousands, and the number of people that are active in these movements are a few thousand maybe. But yet they thought that they were, you know, it was important to sit down and have a clear ideology and a clear platform. And that's why in Ramla, right, I don't know if anybody here has ever been to Ramla. Ramla is outside of Tel Aviv. If anybody here has ever been to Shalavim is actually near Ramla. I lived in Shalavim for 3 years. So Ramla was before Modi'in was built, that was the biggest city nearby. But it was mostly an Arab city then, still is. So Ramla, it's actually funny why they met in Ramla. Ramla was still completely, there weren't any Jews that living in Ramla, but these were all basically, you know, quote unquote refugees from anti-Semitic Russia. And the idea of starting a Zionistic political movement, they felt it needed to be, there was no way to do it other than in secret. So that's why they meet in a hotel in Ramla. This is the leaders of Pohelei Tzion in Palestine, and they get together and they put together a platform. Now, this platform, the Ramla, which ends up becoming known as the Ramla platform, would basically fall into the dustbin of history if Ben Gurion's name was not attached to it. So it's again, we'll read through it. I have the primary source here, so source number two on page two. Not because this is so important as much as because this is you get a sense of the early thinking of Ben-Gurion as a 20-year-old. Human history is marked by national wars and class wars. I don't know if anybody's ever read the Communist Manifesto, but that's the opening line of the Communist Manifesto, except for the fact that they added national wars. Right? The whole idea of communism was that human history is marked by class wars, right? It's the rich and the poor, and they're all constantly at each other's throats, and that's why we need to come up with this new system of a collective in which everybody basically shares everybody else's productivity. The methods used to produce basic necessary commodities, right? I'm still in source number 2, second paragraph. The methods used to produce basic necessary commodities and the natural and historical conditions of the production process have divided humanity into societies and classes, right out of Marx. Certain methods of production create privileges for the ruling classes, which result in class warfare between rulers and oppressed masses. The former wish to maintain and strengthen their privileged positions, while the latter wish to revoke them. Under certain conditions, when the means of production are no longer sufficient for the development of creative forces, the nation is impelled to seize a foreign economic base, territory that creates resistance on the other side, thus war between nations ensues. Okay, so basically the first three paragraphs are straight out of Marx, right? What we would call, you know, in our today's political parlance, we would say, the system is rigged, right? It's rigged. The whole thing is rigged because as soon as you have the imbalance of the wealthy and the poor, the wealthy are more in position to get wealthier and the poor are not. This is gospel when it comes to, you know, for socialism. And then they add this paragraph at the end about how the result of all of this is national struggle. So there, again, if the idea of Paul Etzion is to combine Marxist socialism and Zionism, so you see how they basically needed to reprint the Communist Manifesto but add into it this idea of Zionism. Now, this is not... Shomer Tzion Today is the same organization. It's just, yeah, it's a youth movement that is, that, oh, I'm sorry, Hashomer Tzair, not a Poel Tzair. Hashomer Tzair was the, yeah.
I mean, sport.
Yeah, yeah. Hashomer Tzair, we'll get into Hashomer. Hashomer started as a self-defense, Poel Tzair is a political movement. Okay, so, so what happened? So this is actually fascinating. The Ben Gurion, they had this founding meeting of the Hapoel Etzion in Palestine. They have this Rambam platform, and Ben Gurion is elected to be the chair, to be the head of Hapoel Etzion in Palestine. Now, for somebody with absolutely no connections, no lineage, and really no talent to speak of, no market talent to speak of, the fact that he was elected at this early stage in his career as the head of something is actually a question that confounds historians. They don't really know. Because there was no evidence, nobody thought of him as a charismatic or in endearing or engaging speaker. Nobody thought of him as particularly convincing. What he was somebody with a deep knowledge of Hebrew, that might have been it, and he might have had ingratiated himself, one of the Shapira thinks, that he might have ingratiated himself into one of the people that was already in a more of a position of influence, and it was his endorsement. Either way, the fact is that this is the point in which Ben-Gurion had his coming out party, and on a much smaller scale than we said than Jabotinsky. But this is the first time in his life, this will be the pattern throughout his life, that a group of people who have an ideology and a goal are sit around to talk about that ideology and the goal and elect and choose Ben-Gurion to be their leader, to be their head, the head of their movement. 1907, so he's the head now of Hapoel Etzion in Yerushalayim. 1907, a guy named Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, everybody remember who he is? Who is Yitzhak Ben Tzvi? Other than the fact that he's this guy in this picture of here?
Second
president, right? Following who? Who was the first president?
Chaim Weizmann.
Very good. Chaim Weizmann, who we will be speaking about next week, who, of course, is Ben-Gurion worked with intimately. So Yitzhak Ben Tzvi arrives in Eretz Yisrael. He was a titan in Hapoel Etzion in Russia. And he arrives, and immediately we're talking about hundreds of maybe 1,000 people. So this is a tiny group of people, but they thought of themselves to be much greater than their numbers, and they felt that Ben Tzvi was a much more senior member of the movement than Ben Gurion, and Ben Tzvi basically takes over as the party leader. Now, Ben Tzvi was everything Ben Gurion was not. He was a congenial, nice man. He made people feel comfortable. He made people feel like he was waiting all day for them. He was a natural politician. Everything that Ben Gurion was not. And he ends up becoming the party spokesman. 1907 in October, right? So that's Yitzhak Ben-Tzvi arrives, and he becomes the party's new leader. In October of 1907, Ben-Gurion moves from the center of the country, and this, Shapira speculates that the reason why this happened is because of the slight that he had by being booted out of the head of the movement in favor of Ben-Tzvi. This is when he moves to Sahara, which is Ilania, I believe, if anybody can confirm for me. I think Ilania is it's a place a little bit southwest of the Kinneret. It was an agricultural commune, a kibbutz, an early version of a kibbutz in the southern Galil, but in the north of the country. So he moves from the center of the country to, he was in Petah Tikva, and he goes all the way up to Sahara, which was, again, I think is called Ilania today. So he's in Sahara, and this is the only point in his life in which he points to work that he did as an agricultural worker and says in a happy light, in a productive light. He felt that this is the period in his life where he was actually doing something that he was good at, that he was naturally good at, and he was effective at. He writes to his father. And all right, before we get to that, so he moves to Sahara in 1908. The Young Turks Revolution restored electoral democracy to the Ottoman Empire. In the 1870s, there was a revolution in Turkey, and the long-standing Ottoman Empire was basically supplanted for a democratically elected parliament. And within a few years, the authoritarian rule was returned. So 1908, the Young Turks Revolution is restores the Ottoman Empire to an elected democracy. So now they're in a representative democracy again, and Ben-Gurion is looking at this. He's living in a territory of the Ottoman Empire and seeing, okay, this is an opportunity. He starts, the wheels in his head start turning. And again, keep in mind, he's 22 at this time. But he's, at this stage in history, like I said before, he is somebody that's seeing history unfold, seeing this as for the historical opportunity that it is. The fact that the Ottoman Empire is in flux means that we have an opportunity to establish something permanent that the likes of which we may never see again. Number three, Ben-Gurion says to us, writes to his father from Sahara and from Ilania in June of 1909. I myself have no inclination or desire to be a farmer, right? I hate the possession of land that binds the owner to it, and I love freedom with all my heart, the freedom of body and mind. He did not like being an agricultural worker. And despite the fact that he looked back on his short period, and I mean short period, sach hakol, in total, he was probably in Ilania for 8-9 months of actual work. And it was broken up because he was constantly going to conferences and he was giving time off because he was this active socialist leader in Palestine. So it wasn't even that much time. But at the same time, he spoke of these years as and I forgot to mention before, this picture up here is on the top corner of this page, is Ben-Gurion when he's a 15 or 16-year-old in, 17-year-old in Warsaw. And you see, what's notable in this picture is that he's already taken off of his Hasidic garb for the popular student's garb that was worn in Warsaw. And this is already, he's still a teenager at this point. This is a picture of Ben Tzvi. Okay, and in 1910, Pohalei Tzion leaders decide to publish a weekly Hebrew newspaper called Ha'achdut. And within weeks, Ben-Gurion is asked to serve as the editor. This is the title page of the first issue of Ha'achdut. Ben-Gurion ended up editing and also writing often for Ha'achdut. He was not a talented writer. I spoke about this last week. Jabotinsky, who was this natural poet, a writer, a novelist, some people would put him on the same plane as Tolstoy. That was who Jabotinsky was. Ben-Gurion never had a talent for writing. He never had a talent for language. He never had a talent for putting words and ideas together in a convincing way. He was somebody who was characterized by his sheer tenacity, but not by his, a natural ability to communicate. 1911, November. Okay, so again, keep in mind the age right now, huh? Yeah. Okay. So in November of 1911, Ben-Gurion departs for Saloniki with Ben Tzvi. He lived with a Jewish family and devoted himself to learning the Turkish language, in which he became fluent. He gets this idea in early 1911 that the best thing that he can do, right? He had his few months of agricultural work, and now he decides, he saw himself as a real leader. The best thing that he can do in the wake of the Young Turks Revolution, and the fact that he saw, at this stage in his career, what he saw was the idea that he had was to create an independent polity that was going to be represented in Turkish parliament. Now that Turkey was going, that the Ottoman Empire was going back to a democracy, so he wanted to have the legal basis for doing so. So, like I pointed out last week, like Jabotinsky, like Menachem Begin, all right, like so many of Israel's founders, he went to law school and he decides, okay, where am I going to go to law school? I want to be a loyal Ottoman citizen. So the place that I'm going to go to law school is going to be Istanbul. I'm going to become completely Ottomanized. I'm going to look like an Ottoman. I'm going to sound like an Ottoman. I'm going to think like an Ottoman, and I'm going to be an Ottoman lawyer. And how could the Ottoman Empire not accept me and not accept my movement when I have these credentials? So in 1911, he doesn't speak a word of Turkish or Arabic. He goes to Saloniki with Ben Tzvi, and he lives with a Jewish family who spoke Ladino. He writes in his diaries this hysterical thing about how he managed to learn Turkish, because the family didn't speak Turkish, the family spoke Ladino, so he basically had to find like the equivalent of a Shabbos goy on the street to come in and translate from Ladino to Turkish to... All right. He needed a couple of people, and he said it took forever to get a sentence. But he was tenacious, and within a few months, he was, like I said, he had a real talent for languages. He was already fluent in Turkish, and he was able to read newspapers and write, and was conversant. And after a few months, he was ready to enroll in law school. So he moves from Saloniki to Istanbul, this stage in his life, he basically demanded of his father that because of the work that I'm doing is so important, I need you to support me, and you can't. You have no choice in the matter. So his father, who was a very devoted father, still living in Plansk, trying to eke out a living, was saddled with the responsibility of supporting his son. And it was a source of turmoil and pain for Ben-Gurion for years that he barely was able to buy bread. Right, he was barely able to feed himself because of the small, meager allowance that his father would send him. And his father sent him everything that he could. So, in October of 1912, again, so you think about it, if he goes to Saloniki in November, so now we're talking about 11 months later, right? He's now fluent, he's talking and sounding and writing and speaking, conversing like a Turk. And he enrolls in law school in Istanbul. Ben-Gurion and Ben Tzvi are together. The top picture on page 3 is a picture of Ben-Gurion and Ben Tzvi, now by this point in full Turkish regalia. You see, they have the thick mustache and the fez and the Turkish-looking suit. And a picture here says 1,000 words. This is the type of effort that they were trying to make here. They didn't want to be Sabranikim. They wanted to be Turks, so that the Turks would accept them, and that was how they were going to achieve their, the national dream of the Jewish people. So he gets involved, right? He's in law school. He turns out to be a magnificent student. We pointed out that the early stages of Jabotinsky in school were a failure, right? A year and a half, he attended 8 classes. He failed every single one of them, right? He barely ever showed up. But he ended up turning out to be a very talented and adept student. But he can't help himself. He's so involved in political Zionism that he's constantly back and forth and back and forth and back and forth all over the place, and he barely spends any time actually in school. So he only ends up doing 2 years of his education in law school, but during that time, he actually does pass and get good grades, but he never actually finishes his law degree. That being said, he goes, right, one of the places that he goes in 1913, he goes to the 11th Zionist Congress and the World Poalitzion Conference, right? So this is the type of stuff that he was doing. He was back and forth and back and forth. He would show up for his exams and he would do well. In July of 1914, he planned to just spend his summer vacation back at home in Ottoman Palestine. And Ben-Gurion, while he's on the boat, hears, right, this is July of 1914, that's when the Germany declared war on Russia, and that's when the World War I broke out in July of 1914. So he hears that this is happening. So what happens? So basically travel at this point is now severely limited where he's able to go. And the Zionist movement took a big hit. We spoke about it last week, about how Jabotinsky couldn't engage in Zionist activity because he was stuck in Russia. He was in Odessa, and the Zionist activity was centered in Berlin, and it was an enemy territory. So in the end, what he ended up doing was becoming a war correspondent, which is how he wound up in Alexandria, Egypt, which is what got him started on the Jewish Legion. Ben-Gurion had a very similar path, but from the completely opposite perspective. So he's back in Palestine in July of 1914. Poalitzion members, so there. Now you're stuck. You're here in the middle of this war. You don't know who to back. You don't know who to side with. Technically, right now, they're Ottoman subjects. Or if they're not committed or declared Ottoman subjects, they at least in practice are Ottoman subjects. They're living in Ottoman territory. So you have to figure out who you're going to back. You have to figure out who you're going to support in this war. And the world, this was a question that was throughout the world. Who is it that you implore? Who is it that you're going to support? Who is it that you're going to support? The U.S. tried neutrality for years and eventually gets in the war on the side of the Central Powers. But Ben-Gurion needs to figure it out. So they have a meeting of Poalitzion in Palestine, right? This active political movement that he used to be the head of, and now Ben-Tzvi is the head of. But Ben-Tzvi and he are now back in Palestine after the war broke out. And they pass a resolution in 1915 for its members to become Ottoman citizens. So at this point, they were immigrants. They weren't yet citizens. They were for everybody to become Ottoman citizens to demonstrate their loyalty to the motherland. And Ben-Gurion and Ben-Tzvi support this decision emphatically. So the idea is, let us become Ottoman citizens, and once we become Ottoman citizens, then everybody's going to love us. Same idea of going to study law in Istanbul. Everybody's going to love us if we do it the right way. If we do it the right way. If we ingratiate ourselves to the Ottomans the right way. Whatever that Yiddish saying is about man plans and God laughs. All right, so they had this great plan. They thought that they were going to be accepted in March of 1915. Right, it was early 1915. The Poalitzion meet in March of 1915. Jamal Pasha takes over the governance of the Ottoman territories. Basically, what happened during the World War I, the empire couldn't be saddled, couldn't be busied with governing any of its territories. So they had independent governors that had 100% authoritarian rule. They could do whatever they wanted. So Jamal Pasha was a Turkish general. He was in charge of governing the Ottoman Palestine at the time. And Jamal Pasha, who was no friend of the Zionists, no matter what Ben-Gurion, no matter how many fezes he wore, pictures he took looking like an Ottoman Turk. So he actually, his thing, the original movement was to expel all Jews from Ottoman Palestine. That was crazy, and this is actually one of the first instances, there are not many, but one of the first few instances in history where the American foreign policy establishment actually gets involved on behalf of Jews in a foreign place, saying how completely disgusting, it's a war crime, it's terrible, and they were successful in shaming the Ottomans, or Jamal Pasha at least, into not expelling all Jews. So what the pshara was, what the compromise was, that they were only going to expel the Zionists because Jamal Pasha thought that he had a good argument and he had a good case to make that the Zionists were naturally against, right? They were Jewish nationalists in our territory. They were naturally against the people of the Ottoman Empire. So those are the people that we're going to deport. So Ben Tzvi and Ben Gurion, who had been attendees at the Zionist Congress and were well known to be Zionists, so they are the first two to go, and they are basically thrown onto a ship. The ship takes them down to Alexandria, Egypt. Alexandria, Egypt they disembark in Alexandria and are immediately arrested as residents of this is British territory now, Alexandria, Egypt in 1915. They are immediately arrested as residents of an enemy power. And through the involvement of the American consulate in Cairo, they end up getting freed. So as soon as they get freed, this is in 1915, they decide that they're going to go to America. I should point out that before they get deported, Ben-Gurion has this idea to start a Jewish army to fight on the side of the Ottomans. Right, but Jamal Pasha wouldn't have it. So the biographer in the Jabotinsky biography that I pointed out last year said it's really hysterical that these two political foes, if both of them had had their way in 1914, then they would have been fighting against each other in two opposing trenches. Ben-Gurion wanted to have a Jewish army fighting to liberate the land on the part of the Ottoman Turks, and Jabotinsky wanted to have the same type of Jewish army, but to liberate the land on behalf of the Central Powers, on behalf of Great Britain. So neither of them get their way for a little while. Ben-Gurion gets taken out of jail and boards a ship to America. And that ends his, I would say, stage two of his life, where he was trying everything that he possibly could do to be a good Turk. And he fails miserably, and they don't want him, and they deport him, and they arrest him, and he gets arrested. So now he's going to go try his luck in America. He gets on a boat to America, mainly because he doesn't know what else to do. Him and Ben get on a boat to America. On the voyage to America, the few weeks that it takes on the ship, that's when he learns English. It's wild. It takes a few weeks on the ship, he learns, and by the time he disembarks, he can read and write comfortably, he can speak comfortably. He has no idea where to go. He doesn't know anyone in America. The only address that he has is the office of Poale Tzion in New York City. So the Poale Tzion office in New York City, that's where he goes. And not because, right, this is all the only thing he was good at. He ends up getting involved in Poale Tzion in New York City. And that is, that what kind of kicks off this next stage in his life. Ben-Gurion, he achieves the beginnings of fame in America, right? And this is really the first time that people outside of his inner circle know who he is, all right, apart from the little bit of publishing and writing that he did in Ottoman Palestine in a few years earlier. In 1916, he achieves the beginnings of fame by publishing a Yiddish translation of a book published by Ha'achdut, right, the periodical in Ottoman Palestine, right, about Jewish pioneers that had fallen. That had been killed in riots and violence. Poale Tzion responds to this success. Right, this book that he publishes, this translation, sells really well. He translated it into Yiddish, by the way, not English. Translates it into Yiddish. It becomes a big seller. And even though he goes on a countrywide tour trying to drum up interest and business for Poale Tzion, he only ends up getting about 150 members. He does not like America at the early stage. His first impression of America is it's exactly what the communists thought of capitalists. The people who are just self-involved, all they care about is themselves. They don't care about movements. They don't care about ideology. All they want to do is be able to hold their job, earn a salary, and move up the socioeconomic ladder. He does not think highly of Americans. But the first thing that actually ignites some latent Zionism in the American Jewish community is this book that he writes, which becomes wildly popular. Justice Louis Brandeis reads this book, and it's actually one of the contributing factors to Brandeis becoming a very, very outspoken Zionist. It's fascinating. Ben-Gurion ends up on this trip, ends up meeting Brandeis. So you think about his age, he's 1915. How old is he in 1915? Do the math. Right, he's a young guy. Nobody knows who he is. Again, we can't emphasize it enough. Not somebody of any particular talent, but he's still gets an audience with a justice of the Supreme Court in the United States of America. It's wild. So so basically the success of this book gets Paul Etzion to start giving him and Ben Tzvi a salary, and they collaborate. They start collaborating on the next on their next project, which is a history of the land of Israel. That history of the land of Israel, past and present. Again, present being in 1916, and he then spends several months, day and night, in the New York Public Library in Manhattan. Doing research to write this book. He's there day and night, day and night, day and night. He's perfectly comfortable in English by this point. And he meets a woman who is a Russian immigrant in the New York Public Library who's helping him out with this, who offers to help him with this book. That is a woman by the name of Paula Munweis. And Paula is the person that he ends up getting married. He marries her, and we're not going to have time to talk about Ben-Gurion's ideology of religion here, but it's suffice it to say there wasn't much. Okay, he gets and he's living in New York City. There's a million Jews living in New York City in 1918 and 1917, and he chooses to get married to a Jewess who is a Russian immigrant by a city clerk in City Hall. Not only that, but so not sanctified was marriage. I mean, it was sanctified in the sense that he was making a commitment, but so not religious. He ran out of the City Hall and ran to work. Right, he ran to the Paul Etzion office and he apologized for being late because he had just gotten married. Yeah. Yeah. So this was not uncommon of this in this era and certainly this era of the world. Okay. April 26th of 1918, Ben-Gurion, okay, so this is, we spoke about the history last time, about the forming of the Jewish Legion, right? Ben-Gurion actually does lobby, he tries to get Brandeis, when he meets with him, he tries to get Brandeis to impress upon President Wilson to establish a Jewish Legion of the American Army. He's looking, I can rouse the millions of Jews that live here, I can rouse Jews to an American Army, but Brandeis is not interested, the suggestion never makes it, and it would have fallen on deaf ears anyway. So the only option that he has shortly after he's married a few months, and then through the work of Jabotinsky and Yosef Trumpeldor that we spoke about last week, the Jewish Legion is forming. We spoke about how there were three battalions of the Jewish Legion. There was the first one, which was made up of Jewish recruits in London area. The second one was made up of recruits in the United States and Canada, and the third one was made up of Jews that are living in Ottoman Palestine. Okay, three battalions. This is the first Jewish army, right? Whatever that everybody says about Tzahal or the Haganah, this is the first Jewish army in a couple thousand years. Now, we didn't get a chance to talk much about it, but I have a few pieces of evidence from this. And this is really, this is one of the most fascinating things that I never knew about until I started reading about this stuff. The fact that there was, in World War I, the British army actually recruited an army of just Jews for the sole purpose of fighting in Palestine. Basically acknowledging, I mean, it's the type of thing that would never happen today, an acknowledgement and a validation of Zionism to the point that we recognize that this is a movement that actually makes sense and means something to you, and we support it, and therefore we're going to facilitate, we need soldiers anyway, we're going to facilitate you fighting for the British crown, also fighting, for the sake of your homeland. Look, this is a poster on the bottom of page 3. This is, first of all, this is a wedding, this is a picture shortly after Ben-Gurion and Paula were married. Up here is a picture of Paul Etzion. After they accept Ottoman citizenship, you see how Ottoman they look. A lot of good that did. And Ben Gurion is right here in the middle. And
Ben Gurion.
The top picture. This is Ben Gurion in the top picture. This is Ben Gurion in the middle picture. And Ben Gurion and Paula in the next picture. The next picture on the bottom here is a picture of an advertisement that was going around in England. Read this advertisement. It's crazy. The Jews the world over love liberty, have fought for it, and will fight for it. Britain expects every son of Israel to do his duty. Enlist with the infantry reinforcements for overseas under the command of Captain Friedman. It's wild. This is a Jewish battalion that's established. They have a rabbi as their chaplain, and they have, instead of Sunday, they have Shabbos off. Absolutely crazy. Take a look. This is, it's all part of the same popular fervor, popular movement in Palestine. Next week, both Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion had nothing to do with the Balfour Declaration. Jabotinsky, I suggested last week, had a lot to do with it indirectly by his lobbying for the Jewish Legion, him and Trumpeldor. Weizmann next week, which are actually, if you come tonight, you'll hear Dr. Rabbi Soloveitchik, he's going to speak about this also. Next week when we speak about Weizmann was really the architect of the Balfour Declaration, and we're going to get into him and the inner politics of the British government during this period. These guys were both on the periphery. He's still in America at this time. And so in August 1918, after he enlists, in April of 1918, he enlists. They train in Nova Scotia. All right. So he writes in his diary that they're taking the train through Maine, and there were Jews that heard about this, that there was a Jewish battalion being formed that lined up on the tracks and made the train stop so that they can shake the hands of these Jewish soldiers. In London, the Jewish battalion that was formed actually marched through the streets of London, and all these Jews, there are pictures of this, all these Jews are standing outside of their kosher butcher shops, and they've never seen anything like this in their whole lives. Jews in uniform marching proudly with the Magen David, they were actually being held up next to the Union Jack, like nothing Jewish history had ever seen in 2,000 years of exile. They were, the goal of these three battalions were to fight for the British government, for the British army in Palestine. Okay, they were going to conquer it from the Ottoman Turks. Take a look over here. So he goes, Ben-Gurion goes with Ben Tzvi to Nova Scotia to train. Take a look at these. Everybody, can anybody, Yiddish speakers, can somebody please translate this this advertisement for me? Eier Alte Neuland. Go to the old new land. Yeah, we need you. In the bottom. Schlist zichon in. Dam Idishin Regiment, the Jewish Regiment. Join the Jewish Battalion. This is an advertisement that was going in newspapers in the United States of America in the early 20th century. Have you ever heard of such a thing? It's crazy. Okay. This is Ben Gurion, right? We have almost the same picture of Jabotinsky in his fatigues, in his British Army uniform while he was training in Nova Scotia. Right? There's two pictures of Ben Gurion. This is actually, so they train in Nova Scotia for a few months. This is the only military activity Ben Gurion ever sees. Because by the time his battalion actually makes it to Cairo, we'll talk about it in a second. By the time he makes it to Cairo, he gets sick and he's stuck in the hospital. And by the time he gets out of the hospital and makes it to Palestine, the war's over. So Jabotinsky gets there in the last couple of months. Ben-Gurion never makes it. So the only military activity that Ben-Gurion ever sees in his entire career before he's leading an army for national survival in 1948 is a few months that he spends. He actually ends up getting promoted as a leader of his battalion in Nova Scotia training Jewish soldiers. The only military activity he ever sees. Some of this stuff is incredible. This is a picture of Pesach. You see it behind you. Pesach of 1919. Right. This is Pesach in Yerushalayim. This is the Jewish battalion, the British Army. Over here is the Pesach Seder. Over here is, this is in Plymouth, England. Plymouth, England was where they did the last stage of their training after they disembarked from Nova Scotia. This is Yom Kippur of 1919. You see, look at this. This is Yom Kippur of 1919. This is a picture that they took on Yom Kippur. There's a chaplain is sitting there in his talus in 1919 in Britain, right? This is just a crazy, wild, this is a camp where they were doing their training.
The Pesach was where?
Pesach, by the time they got to Pesach, they were in Yerushalayim. Yeah. Okay, so while in Cairo, 1918, we're going to finish in 5 minutes because way too long. While in Cairo, Ben-Gurion fell sick and is hospitalized, and he reads and this is probably the most important point in his life because that's when he reads the writings of Burl Kathnelson. Burl Kathnelson ends up becoming one of his greatest friend and his most important political ally. Burl Kathnelson was an outspoken, very talented, very, very articulate socialist theorist in the nascent movement of socialist Zionism in the Ottoman Palestine, which then shortly at this point becomes British Palestine. Together with him and Ben-Gurion, they set out on a career in basically advocating for and promoting the idea of the Jewish worker, the idea of the Labor Party. That's what he spends the next 10 years as an advocate for the Jewish Labor Party. This is a picture of Kathleson. This is a picture of Ben-Gurion speaking at little groups. He spent 10 years running around trying to drum up support for this movement of a labor union throughout Palestine. He formed several labor unions. We're not going to have time to get into all of this. But that's what he spends the next 10 years. The next stage of his life, the way I put it here, the next stage of his life is the national Jewish leader of British Palestine. How did that happen? Because he spends that decade working towards this goal of establishing this movement of a socialist workers' party, all right, a workers' union within the land of Israel. And then he gets to 1930. 1930, Achdut HaAvodah finally joins, after 20 years, finally joins, 15 years, finally joins with Hapoel HaTzair. Hapoel HaTzair, which was stubbornly refusing to join Pa'alei Tzion, they finally joined together. Achdut HaAvodah, it was a combination with what Pa'alei Tzion ended up becoming in Israel, in British Palestine, and then they finally joined Hapoel HaTzair. Now, Ben-Gurion is now the leader of a movement, because they got Hapoel HaTzair also, that is a significant nucleus in the land of Israel. June 30th, 1931, the 17th Zionist Congress in Basel. Ben-Gurion's party wins 29% of the delegates. This is probably the most critical point for the political history of the land of Israel. or at least in the 20th century. Okay, and with this, I think we're going to close. Ben Gurion, 1931, has his labor movement that he's now established, and it's bigger than it's ever been because of the political maneuvering that he does in the previous decade. Yet he wins the highest number of delegates, 29% of the seats of the delegates in the Zionist Congress in June 30th of 1931. Jabotinsky's party, the revisionists, which we didn't really have a chance to get into last week, the Jabotinsky's party, which was what the world today calls right wing, I think that the probably most unique feature or the most blatant feature of the revisionists versus the laborites was friendly or more hostile relations towards Britain. But Jabotinsky wins 21%. It's the second highest party, the second highest political movement. No small thing. And then there are two other sub-movements, the Mizrahi, right, the religious Zionists, and the general Zionists, which were the people that just liked Zionism but didn't have any particular ideology attached to it. So now Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion now fight. This is a political coalition battle. Fight for the support of Mizrahi and the general Zionists. And Jabotinsky, who was the real ideologue, he was the one that was passionate about his, probably more so, even more so than Ben-Gurion, he was the one that was had a very hard time compromising. And he was thinking about it, and he finally decides one night, you know, after a long night, Jabotinsky decides, okay, I'm going to accept the coalition demands of the Mizrahi and the general Zionists. And he wakes up the next morning only to find out that the previous day, Ben-Gurion had established the coalition with them. And because of that, Ben-Gurion becomes the leader of the dominant faction of the Zionist Congress. And by that point, he uses the bully pulpit to shout Jabotinsky out of popular favor. And by the next Zionist Congress, they have a much smaller showing. So that was the point. Had that gone, that one night been a little bit different, then the politically, ideologically, economically, who knows what would have happened. We know how history unfolded, but that was the point. At that moment, in 1931, is when Israel, what became Israel, what was the Jewish settlement in Palestine, became a labor movement, which was, like we said, was the case until 1977. All right, I'm going to leave the rest of this to you to peruse. I have up here until 1941. Ben-Gurion dies in 1949. I'm sorry, 1973. Of course, in 1948, he's by this point. I guess what I want to—I'm glad that we got to that point in 1931, because that's the point at which he becomes the undisputed leader of the Jewish population in British Palestine. And because of that, and I guess we'll just end with this. Right, there's a lot more to this story, but that's why a few years later, when Hakamat HaMedina starts to happen, right, in the years leading up to it, he is the natural leader because he's the one that has this leadership role already ironed in from 1931, and that's why he's the George Washington. He's the George Washington because he's the name that everybody knows. He's the tenacious, talented, charismatic leader who is not particularly good at politicking, but is the face and the name and the voice that everybody is familiar with, which is why at the Hakamat HaMedina, when the interim government is established and he is declared the head of the interim government, everybody accepts it, and which is why it becomes the acceptable thing that when he Ad Kedei Kach, that 6 months later when they have the elections for the first Knesset, Ben Gurion's Labor Party trounces everybody else and he becomes the dominant party, which again was the trend until 1977. The rest is something that we're more familiar with, but the rest is very, very nuanced and detailed, but the rest is history. Thank you all very much. Bezrat Hashem, next week we're going to talk about Chaim Weizmann and the inner politics of the British Empire during the early 20th century. Hashkoach, everybody. Thank you so much.